Money FM 89.3, best of weekends.
Joining us on our international news review, Steve Okun, senior advisor at McClarty Associates. Steve, welcome back to the show. Big news this week here in Singapore, the population shift on our little red dot. What's the significance of that?
You know, the foreign employment community, you know, from expats to work pass holders are, you know, watching this, you know, watching this very intently. You know, you're getting messages like when Singapore Airlines announced that they were going to have such a reduction of their workforce, that the focus was going to be on foreigners. And that, you know, when the Ministry of Manpower talks about the reduction in employment overall, the focus is going to be a reduction on foreign employment. So there's a nervousness for people, one, who, you know, need those work permits to be here, but also for those who have a job, you know, who have businesses that rely on foreign workers, especially in the construction area and in hospitality, even though that's obviously way down now. So a lot of uneasiness or a little bit of uneasiness anyway.
Of course, we've seen in the past 7-8 months quite a lot of work pass holders and other foreigners who are working here return home for various reasons, some economic, some otherwise. And so there has been a decline in foreign population here, at the same time that there's been an increase in Singaporeans returning to Singapore. And the number of overseas Singaporeans has shrunk and is now coming back here. Do you think this will be part of a trend that we will see that will impact business in ways that perhaps we don't fully appreciate yet?
Well, that's certainly going to have that impact because the you know, people are coming home to Singapore because Singapore is doing much better in handling COVID than almost any country. And certainly the countries where, you know, most of the expats like to go, or the Singaporeans like to go for jobs, you know, be it the U.S., the U.K., Australia, all having very difficult troubles handling COVID and with their economic recoveries. So it makes much more sense for them to be here. And that is, you know, part of what's happening. And until the world gets back to shape, and this is going to be a year or two, you're going to see this. Another interesting trend is automation. And that's going to take, you know, jobs away here as well, especially in the services sector. So you've got COVID, you've got a concern for each country, their own citizens and how they're going to take care of them. And then you have automation on top of that, eliminating service jobs. And it's all decreasing, all pushing that trend towards decreasing population, even though you have the offset of the Singaporeans coming home.
Singapore has had an uneasy relationship within its workforce for quite a number of years now. This isn't just a recent thing. This goes back, you know, 10, 15 years at least, between this interplay between locals wanting, needing, and being deserving of good, high-paying jobs, and the perception, at least, that foreign experts can do those jobs better because they already have that experience. This is it's a social and a political challenge in Singapore for nearly everybody on every side of this equation. Where is a common ground that you think might be reached or that you see emerging in terms of how we look at this challenge? Businesses have to run. They need the best qualified people. But at the same time, we do need to get Singaporeans in some of those jobs anyway that have traditionally been held by foreigners.
Well, look, Singapore has found the middle ground, I think, because certainly look at the United States. This was an issue there. It's what helped fuel Donald Trump's win in 2016, you know, build the wall, ban immigration, ban Muslims, keep foreigners out. That's part of why he won in 2016. And it could be why he wins re-election in 2020. It fueled, you know, the Brexit vote with the UK on immigration. So Singapore has done a much better job of finding that balance, of being integrated into the global economy, of welcoming foreign talent that is going to help the country succeed, but also protecting your own workers. And where the business community has stepped up in Singapore, but needs to do even more, is help Singapore's government achieve that aim. You do that by promoting Singaporeans from within, by giving them those opportunities to take those expat roles so that when they come back, they can then move into those regional roles that have typically been reserved for foreign expats, especially, you know, in the financial services sector. So Singapore has done a good job of the balance till now. I think it will continue to do that. And I think the foreign business community or multinationals are recognizing they have more of a role to play too.
Steve, one of the challenges or one of the points that has been mentioned in relation to Singaporeans moving up into upper management jobs is that at the middle manager level, not as many Singaporeans are willing to go overseas to get overseas experience that would then qualify them for some of the bigger, higher end jobs once they return to Singapore. Now, you consult businesses around Asia. You've known a lot of people around the world in different businesses. Do you see this as still being a challenge for Singaporeans that would like to have some of these higher level jobs, but perhaps just haven't had the overseas experience that might, you know, make them qualified for them?
Well, an anecdote, so I don't want to say this applies to everybody, but, you know, one issue you have is that when you get to be ready to move for those expats assignments, you typically have a family. You know, it could be the husband, it could be the wife. You typically have school age children, and you don't want to move them out of the Singapore school system for 3 or 5 years because very difficult to come back in. So they may be turning down those, they may be offered the assignments, they turn them down because it's better for their family. And then the businesses say, well, we tried, but look, there's a systemic issue here and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, the businesses are going to have to do something about that. Maybe you get people the experience earlier in their career before they have to pull their kids out of school. Maybe you break it up into small chunks. Instead of saying, we're going to give you a 5-year assignment, we're going to give you a 3-month assignment. Now, is it as good? Maybe not, but you have to accommodate where you are. And I think businesses are starting to recognize that now, as opposed to saying, well, that's just a system. We offer it. It gets turned down. There's nothing else we can do about it. And that's why they're not, why Singaporeans aren't getting regional roles. Well, you have to adapt to the system you're in. And I hope that businesses are going to start doing that.
Yeah. Interestingly, next weekend, we're actually going to have a guest on talking about this from the other side, from the Singapore perspective as well, Singaporean on the line. So we'll definitely get some interplay on this very complex issue, but one that is absolutely vital to Singapore as its business community moves forward. Let's move forward us and talk about Thailand and the unrest there. What's that doing for the business community and the social community as well?
Well, I said, the business community here is watching the interplay is playing out in terms of foreign employment and local talent and all of that. In Thailand, there's a lot more anxiety about what's happening and on the ground and what impact that could have, to businesses, let alone, of course, most important, what impact it could have to Thailand itself. And we'll give a shout out to our friend Shashank Bengali from the Los Angeles Times of Singapore, the bureau chief here for Southeast Asia. He just wrote a great article in the LA Times walking through the situation on the ground. The pro-democracy demonstrators have made, one of their most provocative moves against the government. And that is because they are now bringing the monarchy directly into the debate.
Yes.
About how the Thai government should be reformed. The Thai government has been very restrained in responding to that right now, probably because they recognize all the focus that social media brings real time to what could happen. Mm. But this is a very tense period, and how this is going to play out is going to impact, of course, not only Thailand, but also how do businesses who do business in Thailand have Thai employees? How are they going to handle this? They have to be thinking about that.
Mm. And then the other, of course, neighbor to the north, Malaysia, just had elections in Sabah yesterday. And based on the results we've seen so far, it looks like this will help to shore up Prime Minister Mujahideen's base and his government at the moment, at the same time when Anwar Ibrahim is knocking at the door, as it were.
Yeah, and the difference between Thailand and Malaysia is Thailand is facing structural issues. What role does the monarchy play in the government? What role does the military play in the government? Malaysia, it's politics. Mm. And Malaysia is not having that structural crisis that could engulf Thailand. This is which political party is there. It gets to, gets to corruption following the 1MDB scandal. It gets to how the government is handling COVID and the economic fallout there. The politics will work out in Malaysia one way or the other for now. And so there is a little bit of an unknowing as to who's going to be ruling the Malaysian government. But the structure will remain what it is today, whichever political party has the power. And that's how you would see it right now. So not nearly as much of a concern from a political risk perspective as it is in Thailand.
Which some Malaysians may argue is part of the problem, right? The structure stays the same no matter who's in office. That's a story for somebody more qualified than myself to talk about, though, however.
Well, I was going to say, we could move to the United States where we were also having a political.
Well, and in fact, that's where we're going next. Tuesday is going to be a big day in the United States. That will be Wednesday morning here in Singapore. The first presidential debate with Donald Trump and Joe Biden. A lot of eyes, quite honestly, are on Biden this time to see if he's going to be able to stand up to what will expect it to be pretty blistering attacks from Trump.
Well, and look, nothing has changed the support for Donald Trump in 4 years, and nothing has changed this year. He's got the same amount of support as he had before 200,000 people died. He got the same amount of support that he had before the U.S. went into the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression. So it's a lot to say that this one debate is going to change everything where nothing else has done it, but maybe it could. And it maybe it could for a couple of reasons. One, this is the only time that these three presidential debates, and the first one's the most important, it's the only time the two of them are going to face off, you know, face to face. They're going to be talking to one another. The debates are designed not to have the moderator do fact checking and not to have the moderator be the referee, but the moderator sets the structure and then the two of them have 6 15-minute blocks to go after one another. Mm-hmm. And if Joe Biden can show the negative impacts of Trump's first term and at the same time make the affirmative case for his presidency and not get tied down into fact-checking every lie that Donald Trump says and not get tied into a name-calling, he could turn the shift and then go from a 7-point margin in the polls to an 8 or 9-point margin, which is what he's going to need to win cleanly on Election Day. Not counting on that happening, but it's a possibility.
Is there a typical percentage bounce that the winner of a presidential poll gets? Is it 2-3%, 5%? Someone who's acknowledged to have done the best in that particular historically.
Well, it's a combination of not doing the best, but exceeding expectations. That's what can give you that significant jump. Two examples of where that occurred were in 1960, in the first televised presidential debate we ever had in the United States between, you know, then Senator John Kennedy, relatively young and inexperienced on the national stage, versus the sitting vice president for two terms, Richard Nixon.
Right.
Kennedy went in with lower expectations. He was perceived to have won, and he, you know, picked up probably 3 points at the end of those debates. So that, because he exceeded expectations, it changed things. In 1984, Ronald Reagan, while he was ahead, there were questions about his, you know, mental acuity. How sharp was he? Was he slowing down because of age? And literally with one line that he used against the challenger, former Vice President Walter Mondale, he put to rest that question and went on to win the largest landslide, 49 out of 50 states.
Yeah.
So it is possible you can have a big shift, but you have to exceed those expectations.
Where is Joe Biden's vulnerability in this presidential debate on Tuesday?
Well, he's got two. The biggest vulnerability is that he shows what Trump has challenged, that he is sleepy Joe or that he is slow Joe. If he trips up on answers, if he makes real gaffes, it could hurt him like it hurt Gerald Ford in the 1976 presidential debate. So one, does he make an own goal, right? An unforced error that plays into the stereotype that Trump has set up for him. If he, of course, puts that stereotype to rest, he really moves forward. So that's the biggest issue. The second, does he not take advantage of the debate? Does he get into a name calling and a fact checking contest with Donald Trump? And I also say Donald Trump has low expectations. And if Donald Trump doesn't, you know, if comes out of this looking, you know, quote unquote presidential or modern day presidential, if he changes the tone and then the public says, oh, well, Donald Trump did a lot better, or he's not, you know, he can do this, that could hurt Joe Biden. So a lot of unknowns going into this.
Wow. And I know you don't, you're not in charge of her schedule, but where's Kamala Harris been? It's almost like she's disappeared from the political stage after that massive announcement and a bunch of interviews and things. She's just been a whisper.
Well, she is focusing on getting out the vote in the particular constituency that did not come out in 2016, right? So you had the Obama-Biden coalition, which was very big in 2012. You know, 6.7 million people didn't vote at all or voted for a third party instead of voting for Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine. Now it's Kamala Harris's job to get them to vote for Biden Harris. And so she's going to those cities. She's talking to younger people. She's going to, in particular, you know, the Black community that stayed home in 2016. So she's not on the national stage. She's really focused on those key demographics and key swing states. Go to Michigan, go to Minnesota, go to Pennsylvania, you know, and do that. Whether that's the right strategy is a different question, but that is the strategy the Biden campaign has for her. Maybe they're not using her enough.
Steve, could she have not done both? Could she have not had some sort of national presence at the same time going after those swing voters, those marginal voters?
Well, I mean, you have to remember, we're in the era of COVID. We're in the era of the pandemic. How do you get on the national stage as you have these big, you know, events and big rallies and bring everybody out? You know, the Biden-Harris campaign has made a very clear choice. We are not going to do anything that is not socially distanced, that is not safe. Donald Trump has taken the opposite approach. And so he's still out there. They're knocking on a million doors. The Trump campaign's knocking on a million doors a week.
Yeah.
The Biden campaign's knocking on zero. And so will people say, how come I have a president who's going to ignore the social distancing? Or is this going to rally his troops and leave the Democrats behind? There's no roadmap to figure out what the right strategy is other than following the medical advice.
Interesting. And I know you have an article coming out, I believe, on Tuesday in the Straits Times, is it?
Yeah, we're going to walk through. My co-author, Thurgood Marshall Jr., and I are walking through the debate. It's going to, we previewed quite a bit of it in our discussion. What is it to watch for? Where does this one fit in historically? How is it that Biden is going to try and keep the focus on the economy and healthcare? And then, of course, we have a Supreme Court nominee now that President Trump just announced. And can that shift things? So much happening right now with less than 40 days to go.
Yeah. And can we just spend a couple minutes on Amy Coney Barrett, who is the district court judge, who is now, as you just mentioned, officially been anointed by Donald Trump as his choice. She's very socially conservative, as many of us have heard, and people are suspecting that she will, you know, bring that voice to the court. With just over 5 weeks until the election, the Senate is going to have to work fast to get her approved. In that time, it will probably happen. What impact for those who may be novices to the U.S. Electoral process, what impact, if any, will this have on the election, do you think?
Well, the biggest impact is, will this change the narrative of the campaign right now? A re-election campaign about a president is typically a referendum on his first term and whether he deserves a second one. Most Americans right now say the country's on the wrong track, that Donald Trump has not handled COVID appropriately, that he's not addressing the racial justice issues appropriately, and that we're not going to vote for him. Therefore, Biden would win. If Trump can use this Supreme Court nomination to change the narrative to being a choice between himself and Joe Biden, and to be able to say, you Republicans, you need to vote for me because I'm giving you the Supreme Court and I'm going to give you all of these conservative things that you want when it comes to abortion, when it comes to guns, when it comes to the oversight of the economy by the government versus business. And if he can make this election a choice based on the Supreme Court, he has a much better chance of winning than if he makes it a referendum on his first term. What Biden is trying to do is to change the question to say, if because of Donald Trump, you Americans are going to lose your health care. Pre-existing conditions are going to not be, insurance companies can turn you down if you have a pre-existing condition, because this justice is going to tip the court and find the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. And you have to vote based on health care. You have to vote based on what this is going to do to your life. There's nothing we can do about it to stop it. So she'll get confirmed, get it behind us, and get back to a referendum. That's how the battle's shaping up right now. And if Trump can use this to flip the narrative, he has a much better chance of winning.
Very interesting week ahead of us and 5 weeks ahead of us. Steve, thanks so much for your insight. As always, look forward to having you on the show next Sunday to recap everything that's happened this week.
Thanks, Glenn.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.